Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In her essay, Trying Out One's New Sword, Mary Midgley coins a term, moral isolationism, that she uses to describe a certain type of relativistic position in ethics. And she's primarily focused on a kind of cultural relativism, but this could be applied much more broadly to other varieties of ethical relativism. For example, those that might have to do with race, class, gender within a society, or to say, you can't understand me and judge me because you don't come from the same background or have the same experiences as I do. And we'll talk about that and those implications a bit later. For right now, let's stick with what she's talking about. So what is what she's calling moral isolationism? It's a standpoint, an ethical perspective on the possibility of having ethical perspectives about those who are different, those who are other, those who belong to another culture. And she says that in our own day, we're hearing about other people's cultures and customs and activities. We see changes in our lifetime which would have astonished our parents. And I'm going to discuss one very short way of dealing with this difficulty, a drastic way which many people now theoretically favor. And this is what she's calling moral isolationism. And she tells us about some of its key features. So what are these? She says, it consists in simply denying we can ever understand any culture except our own well enough to make judgments about it. So we can't praise, condemn, justify, explain any other cultures. We can only understand our own culture. We can only understand the culture that we either were born into or were adopted into and were raised within, or perhaps even had imposed upon us if we lost the culture that we originated from in the first place and were sort of brainwashed into that. We get one and that's it. So whatever it is that you're working with, that's your one culture. It's impossible from this point of view to be the cultural equivalent of bilingual. You cannot straddle multiple cultures. You wouldn't be able to do, for example, what they call code switching in language, using the language of one culture as opposed to another culture, or rather subculture. That would be ruled out as a possibility because you can only understand one. So we can only understand our own culture. Why? Because, as she puts it, societies are something like hermetically sealed off units, each with its own system of thought. It has its own material implements, which we can see at museums or in other places like National Geographic, you know, or whatever other things that you're getting popular anthropology in. And each one of them is radically different from the other. They may borrow things from each other, but the same thing within a different culture has a totally different meaning that we can't possibly fathom. Every single culture is its own world unto itself. A third very important part of this, as she says, a wonderful metaphor, is that moral judgment is a kind of coinage valid only in its country of origin. So moral judgment would be saying things are good or bad, right or wrong, better or worse, desirable, undesirable, the sorts of things that we do in praising, blaming, criticizing, justifying, suggesting. All of that would be possible only from within the standpoint of one's own culture. So if this is really the case, that implies that unless we have some radical continuity between, say, us and ancient Athens, we can't even understand the moral perspective of Socrates or the moral perspective of the ancient Israelites in the Bible, or the moral perspective of Rome, let alone the moral perspective of 16th century China. All of those are sealed off containers. Any moral judgments that were made are only valid within those systems. And so along with this goes the implication that we, since we cannot understand, we can't make judgments about, and we can't even morally reason about other cultures, their practices, their works, their justifications, their social structures. None of that is things that we could understand and then judge and then reason about. We can't say whether they're better or worse. We can't compare them with each other. They simply are what they are for the people who are living with them. And for everybody else, it's a matter of hands off. Now, that's a very strong relativist position. It's not just saying that different people have different moral codes. It's saying we literally cannot make sense of the moral code of a different culture, so we cannot evaluate it in any way whatsoever or use it as a point of comparison and contrast, either with our own culture or with other cultures. Why might a person take a position like that? So she brings up three main things. One is that within the culture that we inhabit, late modern Western culture, she's writing from a British standpoint, but this could equally apply to Americans or pretty much anybody in the first world, we tend to value respect and tolerance for other cultures. That is, when we're not engaging, say, in cultural appropriation or making fun of them in racist ways or doing things like that. But there are many of us who do think that it's important to respect other cultures, to show tolerance. You know, you see somebody doing something that looks a little bit unusual, you can just say, well, they're from a different place. What they're doing has a different meaning to them. I'll give you a great example. At a very, very fancy dinner, one of the guests of honor, who is from the American West and grew up on ranches, took the fancy dinner napkin and blew her nose in it to the astonished and, in some cases, disgusted stares of all the onlookers, well, at least some of the onlookers, because some of us were like, well, you know, that's what napkins are used for in other places. That would be showing a kind of tolerance or a respect for that culture. And instead, quite a few of the other people took offense to that and thought that it was very wrong to do. The napkins all get washed in the same washing machine as everything else. Another thing that she talks about is concerns about the opposite, about people despising other cultures, saying terrible things about them. Look at those barbarians. Look at those dirty savages. Look at those people over there who do this thing. Or it could be joking about them. It could be all sorts of things, caricatures. Oppressing other cultures, steamrolling, to use her term, other cultures. Maybe the idea is that if we adopt this moral isolationism, we don't try to change everybody to make them like us, which in fact was something that did occur. A prime example of that is the indoctrination of many people from different Native American tribes for generations here in the United States, very often in church-run schools. They were going to make good Westerners, good Americans out of these Native Americans or First Peoples. And in effect, they managed to deracinate them from their own culture, produce all sorts of, you know, bad emotional effects and complexes, and didn't give them what they really needed to succeed in the white culture of the time, where they probably wouldn't have succeeded anyway. So maybe, you know, if we're attuned to those sorts of problems, we might adopt something like moral isolationism. Let people live over here and live the way that they want to. Don't try to indoctrinate them. Don't try to remove their culture. Don't try to destroy it. One of the reasons why Midgley at the end talks about this becoming sort of a paradigm is because we look at the fruits of anthropology as if they are showing us human nature as such. So she tells us that the universal predicament of culture, which is that cultures borrow from each other all the time, has been obscured by the fact that anthropologists used to concentrate largely on very small and remote cultures, which didn't seem to have this problem of cultural borrowing. These tiny societies, which had often forgotten their own history, made neat, self-contained subjects for study. And she goes on and says, no doubt it was valuable to emphasize their remoteness, their strangeness, their independence of our cultural tradition. This emphasis was, I think, the root of moral isolationism. And so that gives you an idea of why somebody might adopt this sort of standpoint. Now, there are some important consequences to adopting this standpoint. There's two of them that she highlights in general, in addition to pointing out a lot of different problems that come up as well. So one is that, as I pointed out already, moral isolationism, as she says, has a general ban on moral reasoning. It rules it out across the board, except within your own framework, except within your own culture. Now, what do we mean by moral reasoning? She says, here's just an example. The power of moral judgment is not a luxury, not a perverse indulgence of the self-righteous. It is a necessity. When we judge something to be bad or good, better or worse than something else, we are taking it as an example to aim at or avoid. Without opinions of this sort, we would have no framework of comparison for our own policy. We could form no judgments on our own actions. And she talks a little bit about Homo sapiens and our brains and how this is actually part of our very nature, making moral judgments. So moral isolationism would rule out most moral judgments that we would make insofar as they involve any sort of reference to anything outside of our own culture. That would be a significant problem. The other thing that she points out is logically, this sort of position should in fact lead to what she calls moral skepticism, which would mean that we would engage in no action at all because we wouldn't be able to judge it one way or another as good or bad. We wouldn't be able to carry out practical reasoning, and we wouldn't have an interest in other cultures or perhaps even in much of our own. And this leads us to a very important point. If you think about a culture, if we talk about something like the West, is the West really a culture? Or is it an incredibly complex network of overlapping cultures, some of which have more dominance than others? How do we treat things like this within our own society? Do we say it matters what race one is classified as within the country that one lives in? Because, of course, we know that race as a socially constructed matter and not merely as genetic correlates to those social constructs is very arbitrary. Changes from place to place, culture to culture, designation to designation, generation to generation. If we adopt a sort of standpoint that says, because I'm not of that race, I can't possibly judge what goes on in that community. I can't even understand it. And they, you know, may tell me that, or other people on the side may say, who are you to judge, or anything like that. Then we're adopting a position of moral isolationism. When we say, listen, you can't possibly know what I'm going through because I have a different sexual orientation than you, I'm a different gender, I come from a different part of the country, you're from the coast, I'm from flyover country, I'm from a rural area, you're from an urban area, well, I grew up in the suburbs, I moved around a lot on different military bases. When we say that we can't understand and therefore can't engage in any moral reasoning or judgment about the actions, the beliefs, the statements of others because they belong to a different group, we're in effect going into something like Midgley's moral isolationism that she's pointing out the problems with here. So her conception of moral isolationism doesn't just apply to cultural relativism. It can apply to ethical relativism much more broadly. Anytime that we have some sort of determining quality or group or characteristic that is supposed to act as a ban on understanding altogether. So that is what Midgley means by moral isolationism, and that is its connection with relativism. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.